Chapter 4 FBI Interviews. In a sterile, white-walled room whose frosted glass interior walls bordered the expansive portion of the main office space, sat the gathering of agency personnel in Washington's FBI headquarters. The audience was composed of individuals that Special Agent Phillips had never met before. In fact, as near as he could tell, of the 12 people there, the director and he were the only two people not wearing visitor badges. It required a few moments to take this information in and process, but it only took a mere glance at the young woman seated next to him to realize she had no desire to be there. With a nod in her direction, Agent Phelps made an introduction. "Hey," he started, "my name's Mike. I'm guessing you're not assigned to this office." Paige Rowland looked his way and shook her head. "I'm Paige, and I'm supposed to be on vacation," her voice carried, and with a curt opening, the director began his briefing with an offered apology.
"I'd like to thank you all for coming in on a Saturday. I realize that some of you are, well, put out, seeing as how most of you here are not affiliated with the FBI. This statement, combined with the 3 cups of coffee, brought Mike Phelps out of his morning doldrums. The director continued. "The president has ordered an interdepartmental investigation to take place involving several intelligence agencies to determine if our deep space network has been hacked, and if so, by whom." It was Paige's turn to take an interest now. She had majored in aeronautical applied mathematics with a minor in cosmology, and had only taken the job at the Department of Defense because of the agency's interest in satellite disruption capabilities of foreign governments. Her thesis had centered on the Russian MiG-31, its flight characteristics, and its ability to destroy satellites from high altitude using advanced missiles. This might be fun, she thought. The director moved on from the implausible to the plausible.
"If NASA and JPL find evidence to support this possibility, we will be tasked with finding the hackers and stopping them. But more than likely it wasn't hacked." This statement caused a few thoughtful looks. "It is a belief of JPL, NASA, and the Department of Defense that the data received from the planet Mars is accurate, which leads us to our alternate objective." After a deliberate pause, he continued. "Identifying the 3 individuals who successfully landed a spacecraft on Mars, left evidence of their presence, and then departed the surface to destinations unknown." Most of the group sat stunned, as was expected. Everyone continued to stare at the director as he appraised the many blank faces before continuing. "We are functioning from a standpoint of need to know for the time being. Based on the recommendation of his cabinet, the president has decided to put a lid on this information until we can better assess the situation." The director motioned to a woman who was seated.
"Everyone, this is Tiffany Schlieve, director of JPL. We were fortunate that both she and the director of NASA were available to sit in. I would like to turn the briefing over to her. Ms. Schlieve." And with a motion of his hand, he moved off to the side and allowed Tiffany the floor.
The remainder of the briefing took about an hour, but by then the group had been given information packets and the same audio-video brief given by James Tyson the day before. There was not much to go on, and with the White House involved, the pressure would be high to get results. The task was straightforward. Find out all there was to know about this assumed landing on Mars while keeping the circle tight. No leaks. If hacking had occurred on Mars, it would likely be embedded not only in the rover software, but in the satellites as well. 2 of the surveyor satellites had already produced images of the site, showing a structure that was not there before. The sensors on the rover were detecting the object without any sign of distortion or editing. Inquiries had been made regarding the words Western Wave with no obvious connection, a domain name that sat unused for years. The owner, a guy who babysits seismic crews and keeps them honest. No companies or financial groups use this combination of words. No bank accounts had magically materialized with the words in the letterhead. Nothing to go on at all, or so it seemed.
"Where do we even start?" blurted out one of the three Langley persons in attendance.
"I'm guessing we start with the bottle," remarked Agent Phelps to himself, which caused the murmuring in the room to mute.
All eyes had suddenly focused on him with a certain lack of regard. "This is who the FBI sends?" each wondered to themselves. The director had a bit more confidence in his agent and was quick to take Phelps seriously before anyone had time to formulate a sarcastic remark.
"What do you have in mind, Agent Phelps?"
"The champagne bottle needs to be examined." His elusive reply didn't help the situation. The director knew that this seemingly pointless conversation the two FBI personnel were having needed a resolution very soon. The audience was beginning to look upon both with doubt.
"Have you got a plan for that, Mike?"
"The rover, sir," he instructed. "Ram the enclosure with the rover and knock the bucket over onto the floor."
"And what good will that do?" came the slightly bewildered question along with a furrowed brow from the head of JPL.
"The barcode, Miss Schlieve. If we can read the barcode on the bottle, we might find out who bought it," Mike said, in a voice that never wavered. It was just so matter-of-fact.
A slight smile crept into one corner of the FBI director's mouth.
"Is it possible?"
he asked to no one in particular.
West interviews.
It had been 3 days since their return to Earth, and what was hoped to be a couple of weeks of relaxation started out as anything but. There was a job that needed doing, one that John did not like, but what could he do? The crew he usually assigned this kind of unpleasant task was indisposed at a camp several hundred miles away and would not return for nearly a week. This couldn't wait. He had already delayed the inevitable. Begrudgingly, he walked over to the vehicle, a machine designed to inflict maximum damage, and after careful inspection, he climbed on and started the engine. "Sounds good," he thought, engaging the twin rotor blades. The motor was brought up to full RPM and John eased off on the brake. After the third pass, John noticed a vehicle approaching his position. A man and a woman got out. Jehovah's Witness? No. Missing the tracks and Bible? His mind wandered. A local politician out stumping for votes? Not likely. Wrong time of year. Perhaps a couple of FBI agents here to inquire about a recent purchase. The thought brought a small grin to his face. They began walking his way, so John shut down the mower and climbed off to meet them. Crossing the road, the visitors were greeted by the same two dogs that had been barking their heads off at the mower. Their owner, Mrs. Jorgensen, was yelling for the dogs to "get back over here," which the dogs seemed to interpret as "bark louder." Her husband, Freddie, was working in the garden and seeing the commotion, called the dogs back.
"Sorry about that," he said. "The dogs see a new face and they..."
"It's the mower that sets them off. Hurts their little ears," cried Mrs. Jorgensen,
who had not let her husband finish a thought since the words "I do" departed his lips nearly 20 years before. Phelps and Roland had flown in that morning from D.C. and rented a car. The drive was pleasant enough. Some small talk about family, schooling, favorite baseball team, etc. There was also the conversation about how none of this made any sense whatsoever. This guy is not part of some clandestine space program, and whatever the surveillance camera and credit card purchase indicated, they were wasting precious time. A quick smile, a wave to the neighbors, and it was down to business.
"Mr. West," Mike started out, "I'm Agent Phelps, FBI, and this is Paige Rowland with the Department of Defense. Could we have a moment of your time?"
So close, John thought as he extended his hand. Having moved inside, the two government officials sat opposite John, each with a small notebook and pen with which to take notes. Agent Phelps started the conversation.
"Do you remember purchasing a bottle of champagne several months ago?"
Mike was hoping the question would rattle him. It was not to be the case.
"I do,"
John responded with a smile.
My daughters and I drank it in celebration.
If you don't mind my asking, probed the FBI agent, what were you celebrating?
Why, the Mars landing, of course, his nonchalant answer made Paige's face go pale. Even Mike was caught off guard by the response.
The alleged landing you refer to only happened a few days ago, began Paige. Where did you hear about it?
Come now, Miss Rowland. We all know it took place. Three astronauts from an outfit called Western Wave landed on Mars and you guys were sent out to investigate. Am I right? The visitors shot uncomfortable glances at one another.
My understanding, John continued, is that the company will be reaching out to the heads of state in short order to share in the good news. Beyond that, I'm afraid I don't know the itinerary. One thing is for sure, the vehicle appears to be functional, and another Mars landing will be made very soon. Exciting, isn't it?
Mike and Paige were floored by this revelation, and by the time they had gotten in the car and drove away, both were amazed by the information and excited that this meetup had paid off. It included a promised outreach through the FBI, soon to be made from this hitherto unknown company. Leaving the small town, both were smiling and talking over each other.
How they couldn't believe their luck, and this guy might not be in the loop, but close enough, and was very nice, and couldn't wait to submit the report, and wouldn't everybody be surprised?
When suddenly, Mike began slowing down the car with a puzzled look on his face.
Hang on, he nearly shouted.
He looked over at Paige. In an instant, she understood, and in one voice they cried, "The champagne!" The lawn was nearly done, so John did not mind the intrusion. Neither did the dogs, who insisted that the newcomers spend a little quality time feeding or petting them. Either would do. John instructed his guests to wait in the house, and within 10 minutes, the yard work was done. During this time, Mike and Paige had settled for the pro-offered beer in the fridge. Glancing around, they saw baby pictures and graduation photos and a few ancient artifacts such as an Apple IIc on an old, well-crafted desk, but nothing to indicate this guy was what they suspected. As John dusted himself off and reached for the screen door, both government employees suddenly had a case of butterflies. Both were nervous, and neither knew why.
"Good, I see you got something to drink. How can I help?"
Mike set his beer on the table.
"Mr. West, earlier you told us that you bought the champagne to celebrate the Mars landing with your daughters. Is that correct?"
"Yes." Mike's next words seemed to get caught in his throat.
"Where were you when you drank it?"
West recollections. The jumping-off point for all trips to the bridge was the west coast of Africa, Angola to be exact. An oil and gas consortium had built a large refinery along the coast that was tied directly to offshore oil wells that were producing. The Weiss Group had investment ties directly with the production facility, so moving equipment and personnel to the bridge through this conduit was established. The final leg of the trip would involve the supply boat to load and unload supplies and people at one of the production platforms. The vessel would then make the trip out to the storage facility 350 miles off the coast, where a vertical floating tank housed the fuel meant for the bridge. Refueling took place at night in calm waters twice a week, if practical. John and the girls had taken the circuitous route to shore 10 days earlier, but Sarah meant to actually fulfill some of her visa requirements. She flew to Cameroon for a 2-week stay at a mobile camp set up by Doctors Without Borders, where she assisted the nursing staff there dealing with refugees from neighboring Nigeria. Sarah had agreed to meet her family in D.C. on the appointed day, after which she would be spending a month finalizing her stay at the hospital where she worked, then taking some time for herself. She had seen the future, and she wanted to be part of it. The evening before the scheduled meeting at the White House, John and his two accomplices ate dinner in the rear of a pizzeria. While plowing through a large multi-topping pie, they went over the presentation that John had put together on his laptop. It included the status of Weiss Harbor installation,
along with Rachel's architectural design layouts for the temporary shelter on Mars. The tentative schedule for equipment movement was discussed, and if located, the layout for the first base. The air was filled with excitement as the presentation was refined to the point where they were all satisfied, each knowing that tomorrow was going to be an interesting day. Upon being ushered into the Oval Office, they were greeted by three people: Maggie Jones, White House Chief of Staff, Jack Terrence, President's Science Advisor, and Liza Pollard, White House Press Secretary. Maggie made the introductions and asked if there was anything the guests needed. Coffee? Water? No, thank you, the visitors replied. Well, we've been reading the report the FBI sent over, and to speak frankly, all of us here are a bit perplexed. Only a bit, thought John as he surveyed the group. They each wore the look a parent might have when the child with chocolate all over its face is flat out denying even knowing about the cake. Let me assure you that the information about our time on Mars is accurate, John stated openly. The president's science advisor gave a snort as he sank back into the sofa. Maggie half turned her head his way, but corrected herself. Turning back to face John, she said, You see, Mr. West, we here in this room are aware of the physical constraints limiting your ability to do what you say you did. It is not possible for you to be sitting here with us today when the landing itself was only 19 days ago. Not only that, but you would have had to have made the trip in not much more than a week to be able to justify the bank card and cell phone usage. Care to explain? The girls knew that the conversation was going to follow this path. Until the step drive existed, what was being discussed was impossible. What the girls were not prepared for was how their father was going to walk everyone through it. John thought about his reply for a couple of seconds. Then, You're right. What I'm proposing is impossible. At least by the physicists, scientists, and educators who seem to think that all that has come before is flawless. Both Sarah and Rachel were waiting for the follow-on to this brief explanation, but when nothing else came out, they both started to feel uncomfortable about being there. The girls were seated on either side of their father, and all they could do was stare straight ahead and hope things improved significantly. Jack Terrence had had enough of this nonsense. Mr. West, are you telling me that you have a spaceship somewhere that can travel from Mars to Earth in a week, which no one is aware of, and also hasn't been detected by our sensors? His voice was dripping with contempt. John looked at his face for several seconds before saying anything. The air was thick, and the girls were fidgeting. Rachel, he finally said. Turning to his daughter, he saw that it had not registered. Rachel, he repeated, and Rachel turned to face him. Her eyes were wide. What is the current travel time to Mars at step two? She regained her composure, pulled out her smartphone, opened the app, and in a firm voice simply said, 4.6 days in its current configuration. John looked back at Jack and repeated, 4.6 days travel time to Mars in its current configuration. You're serious, aren't you? Came the words from the open door to the left. Everyone got to their feet as the president entered the room. He walked up and stood several feet in front of John and repeated his question. Yes, sir, John replied. We've made the trip to DMOs 6 times, offloading supplies and equipment. The last time was when Sarah, Rachel, and I took a smaller vessel down to the planet. That vessel is still parked on DMOs. Our primary conveyance made the round trip.
There isn't anything on Deimos, framed the objection from Mr. Terrence. We are all being played somehow, and personally, I'm offended by this entire conversation. We came bearing gifts, Sarah managed to say without her voice cracking.
Gifts, the president repeated.
Rocks and soil samples, Mr. President, she managed. This is ridiculous, was a follow-up by his science advisor.
Mr. President, if I may, John quickly parried. These are my 2 daughters, Sarah and Rachel West. The president offered each of them his hand. To John, he simply faced him. No hand was offered, none was expected. They just stood there looking at one another. After several seconds, the president finally said, "Sir, where is this gift of yours?" "It's at the guard station in my purse, Mr. President."
"Maggie?"
"Yes, Mr. President?"
"Please ask the guard to look in her purse for the bag of rocks, would you?"
Yes, sir." She managed to get out, still looking at the two men squared off in the Oval Office, not sure what to expect next. Sarah spoke up.
"The bags are sealed and should remain that way."
"Why, afraid of what we'll find?" The dry question from Jack was vapid.
"We sealed all the samples in the Martian atmosphere. Breaking the seal will release the gas," John said, never taking his eyes off the face in front of him. Jack's mouth opened and closed. He repeated this motion two more times before finally saying, "I'll go see." He got up and walked to the door.
"Well, Mr. West, you seem intent on making us believe the impossible," the president said, moving to take the seat that Jack had just vacated.
"It was impossible about 8 months ago. Now it's becoming routine." John's air of unflappability slowed his daughter's pulse rates as they all sat back down.
"Okay, for the sake of conversation, where is this ship of yours?"
The president had settled for an explanation.
"Rachel," John said,
"can you give the president a synopsis of our current status?" Rachel began rattling off facts and figures regarding the two moon settlements, 3D seismic mapping progress, borehole progress, and personnel. She then began spewing the list of equipment currently on Deimos and the expected 1-year progress the crew hoped to make on Mars once the shelters were positioned and manned. But she made no mention of the bridge. That was sensitive to the point of scary.
"How are the people and equipment moving off the Earth without any detection from our radar or satellites?"
the president asked while rubbing his eyes. Rachel finished with,
"Dad, this one's yours."
She was not going to touch it. Maggie broke in and asked if anyone needed refreshments or anything, which prompted the girls to raise their hand and ask where the bathroom was. John settled for a black coffee, and a tray with several cups and saucers arrived soon after.
"I call it the bridge,"
John spoke after taking his first sip. The question had lingered far longer than it should have.
"The bridge?"
"Yes, sir."
"It is a high-altitude launch platform that I designed and got funding to build several years back. Originally meant to make money off the current rocket boosters being launched into orbit. I found a better use for it," he said, as a matter of fact.
"And that use is to get ships to the moon with this step drive Rachel spoke of?"
the president queried.
"No, sir.
The skiffs that ferry people and materials are powered by a plasma engine. The step drive is what allows for long-distance travel. The plasma engine is not new science, but mine has been enhanced to the point where it functions more efficiently than a typical chemical rocket. The step drive is a completely new branch of physics, sir," said with respect.
"Okay, let's say I believe you. Where is this bridge of yours?"
"It's about 400 miles offshore in international waters, at an altitude of about 50,000 feet.
"Seriously?"
The question from the president was not serious. "Seriously," John's answer was, and the president knew it. "But it's not where I want it to be. Currently, to make things happen, I must bend certain rules, and what I would like would be for this all to be open and honest and without the secrecy. I would like to be able to have permission from a government to be able to operate from their shores and transfer the people and material in the open." At that moment, the girls made their way back into the room. Maggie was just getting off the phone with a caller and pointed out to the president that he had another appointment in 15 minutes that he needed to prepare for. Standing, the president offered his hand once again to the girls, and then to John.
"I'd like to continue this conversation. Can we schedule a date and time?"
"Of course, Mr. President. It would be my honor."
Maggie took the contact information and said she would get with the president and schedule another meeting. As they walked out of the White House, John had an eerie feeling that it had all gone wrong. He had a fitful sleep that night, and the next day he saw the girls off at the airport and made his way back into town. Might as well be a tourist for a while, John thought, hoping that Maggie would let him know soon. He did not want to hang around Washington any longer than he had to. White House papers. The recessed ceiling lights illuminated a wood-paneled, gray-carpeted, nondescript room in the White House. Not meant to impress or overwhelm, but merely serve as a place where high-level discussions could take place without fear of eavesdropping. No outside electronic devices were allowed inside the room, and it was checked regularly by highly trained individuals with exceptional clearance levels, sporting sophisticated equipment to ensure that it remained that way. The conference room was designed to comfortably seat 22 people. Currently, only 5 of the chairs were in use, but the video screen at the front of the room displayed another 9 in 4 individual frames. The president, vice president, his science advisor, press secretary, and chief of staff were all watching the screen and listening to the woman speak. Paige Rowland finished up with, "Because of my background, he did say that as long as I aced the written exam, there is no reason I couldn't move on to lunar trials." The president followed up with, "That's what he said? Lunar trials?" "Yes, sir. I believe he means that if I can hack working on the moon, then I would be a candidate or something. I'm not sure of the nomenclature." "And what would be your feelings about such an assignment?"
"I'd do it in an instant, sir. In a heartbeat," she said, smiling.
"Judging by the report that both you and Agent Phelps turned in, you found him an honest sort of person?"
"Yes, sir," she surmised. "The questions you ask have to be direct, but yes, he appears honest. He doesn't give up information freely. Your questions have to be designed to elicit a response."
"Thank you for your assessment, Miss Rowland. If we have anything further to ask, we will be in contact."
"Thank you, Mr. President," she said, nodding to the camera before signing off.
"Okay," the president began. "I'm not looking for opinion or hyperbole, just the facts that are available to us right now. I want to go around the assembled and get information. Let's start with you, Mossy. What can you tell me about the platform he calls the bridge?"
"Sir, it wasn't hard to find once we pieced together his travel habits and the altitude John said it functioned at. The pad is about the size of a baseball diamond and is very stable for the height it is at. There is no obvious mechanism providing the lift, but we suspect a series of rotating blades, but that is just a guess. The underside is not visible to our satellites. The upper surface is colored in a way to appear opaque, and the skin likely has a high concentration of carbon composite with a ferrite coating to help mask its signature."
"Are there any indications it is armed in any way?"
"Not from what we can detect, no, sir."
"Moving on, then," the president addressed Admiral Wynne with the Joint Chiefs. "Admiral Wynne, what can you tell us?"
"We had a fast attack sub, the USS James Bennett, patrolling 200 nautical miles to the southwest of the floating tanker. It is making its way there at 15 knots. Should arrive within the next 8 hours, at which point we can launch a Falcon drone to get a better look. We will not be able to get to his altitude, but the cameras will give us a good look."
"What do we know about the tanker?"
"Sir," the admiral continued, "satellite photos show a dome protruding from the ocean to a height of approximately 4 meters. It is 8 meters across and floating directly below the high-altitude platform. Intel suggests a tank with an approximate length of 20 to 30 meters that is floating vertical below the surface. It is a very stable arrangement. No matter the surface waves, the structure will simply bob up and down with no side-to-side movement. We are assuming that thrusters are doing the station-keeping for the tank."
"So this is a refueling station, I take it?"
"Yes, sir.
The platform would require refueling regularly, and if our guess is right, the fuel comes right from the Sonaga refinery on shore. At least 3 supertankers are refueling at the offshore pumping station at any given time, and more than one of these ships has a regular course that could easily intersect with the floating depot and offload fuel. What kind of illegalities are we looking at here? The president's question was open to the floor. Bob Fulton, director of operations for the CIA, spoke up. If they keep it above board, the tanker's manifest would indicate that a shipment was purchased and offloaded en route to the ship's destination. If the paperwork shows a transfer and payment of goods, there would be nothing illegitimate. Bob, do we have intel that would suggest the Angolan government is aware of the platform and the submerged tanker? There is nothing to suggest they are aware. No flybys or no military craft diverting to inspect. Nothing, sir. The director continued after a slight pause. There is, however, the movement of personnel and equipment. If the Angolans were to become aware of this deception, then all hell's going to break loose. I'm guessing there are contingencies, but the expats using the platform would be scrutinized from then on. It wouldn't be a pleasurable experience for them. So the people come in on work visas and then disappear for a while, is that about right? I believe so, sir. The president glanced over at the VP, Susan Capshaw, and their eyes locked. She was still getting up to speed regarding the revelation of the previous day. Holding each other's stare, the president asked his science advisor, Jack, what can you tell us about the samples we were given? Jack Terrence cleared his throat and said, They appear to be legit. The president blinked and slowly rotated his head back to the center of the long table. Analysis of the gas in the sealed bags is consistent with the Martian atmosphere. We were given 3 sample bags and 2 have already been looked at by our team of experts, who all say that the rocks and soil match what the rover has been seeing at Olympus Mons. The 3rd sample is on its way to JPL, where they will have the backup rover equipment reanalyze the sample to see how well the 2 rover spectrometers and soil analyzers match up. And the probes? Anything from them? Asked the president. Yes, sir, Jack acknowledged. We've gotten redundant radar and camera images of Deimos from several angles, using 2 different satellites, and both show reflective bodies on Deimos that weren't there last year. The Lunar Surveyor mission was able to bring their dormant satellite back online and obtain photographic evidence of activity on the surface of the moon. Rachel's description of the seismic survey gave us signs to look for, and there are parallel tracks along significant portions of the surface in places, indicating vehicle movement. There's no doubt. They have a team up there. The president looked back over at his VP, then slowly eased himself back into the chair, stretched, and clasped his hands behind his head. For a long moment, he closed his eyes and pondered. No sound was forthcoming. Holding this relaxed posture, he said, Maggie, thoughts? Without thinking, she said, Let's shoot him and take his stuff. A round of laughter broke the spell and the mood lightened. Where's West at now? The president mused. He was touring the Library of Congress, but I believe he's making his way over to the Madison Cafe. I can't blame him. Maggie's not-so-subtle comment made everyone's stomach begin to growl. They ordered in lunch. West interviews. The Madison Cafe was becoming a favorite for John West, as his stay in the Capitol was allowing him time to catch up on his country's history. Today, the mistake was thinking that the roast turkey would simply be accompanied by the mashed potatoes and gravy. However, upon returning from the buffet line, John questioned whether the mac and cheese, green beans, and cornbread were going to be too much. They were. The call came in just as John was paying his lunch ticket. Well, that was well-timed, he thought, and walked out of the cafe. The car stood waiting for him, and it drove him to the residency of the president. Maggie was waiting outside, and as they walked in, John complained about being underdressed, but truthfully, at that moment, he wished only for a firm bed,
a soft pillow, and 20 minutes of solitude. Instead, he was shown into the green room where the president was waiting, and upon Maggie's departure, John was motioned to a seat. Looking around, he tried and failed to identify most of the paintings that hung majestically around the room. The mantle of the now-still fireplace was accented by an antique clock, whose light chime announced the quarter hour. It was accompanied by silver candlestick holders on either side, below a painting of Benjamin Franklin. The chandelier in the center of the room glistened from the light that reached it from the two windows along the south wall. As he thought about maybe springing for one of the tours of the place, the president spoke up.
"Well, Mr. West, we have utilized a significant number of assets to falsify your claim, and we haven't been able to do it."
"I see." Not at all surprised by this tidbit of information, John felt his stomach grumble its displeasure.
"What are your plans for this technology? Is it something you are willing to share with us, with the world? How do you plan on profiting from it? How do you see the United States fitting into the grand scheme?"
The questions flowed out of the president's mouth without giving him a chance to answer. It was obvious. There were more than a few skeptics in the president's orbit, and this man was likely one of the biggest.
"You see, Mr. West, from where I sit, the facts support the story, which means this new tech of yours scares the hell out of me."
His eyes were piercing, but John's demeanor had not changed. "The ability of this new tech of yours to drive existing businesses into bankruptcy is bad enough." John held his gaze, but said nothing. The president pushed forward.
"The idea of foreign governments gaining access to this technology and possibly using it against us is frankly out of the question."
At this obvious juncture, John spoke up. "The idea of any government gaining access to this technology, Mr. President, scares the hell out of me." His face was controlled, but the voice conveyed real conviction.
"Mr. President, I have no intention of sharing this tech with anyone."
"John," the president shot back,
"you have obviously shared it with a lot of people already. How am I supposed to interpret that?"
"If I were to disappear today, sir, the research disappears with me. I am the only person alive who understands it, knows the math behind it, and can implement it the way I have."
"I don't believe you," the president said smoothly. "There is no way that can happen."
"Believe it or not, I built each of the drives. There is a team I use to construct the interface hardware from the specs that I draw up, but they do not have a clue how it works, and I made each drive tamper-proof. If any of the drives are screwed with, to gain access to the heart of the unit, they destroy themselves in a way that is irreversible. It's unlikely anyone would try after the first failure."
"And why is that?"
"People are inquisitive by nature. Throw a puzzle at them and they'll spend a lifetime trying to figure it out."
"Because I only plan on having a small number of step drives operational in the system, and the person who knows how to make them, that's me, by the way, isn't around very often to make more," John continued. "You can think of the safety I built in like a cryptex from the movies. If the unit is forced open, a vial of vinegar breaks and the message written on papyrus is erased. If my drive is forced open, the structure shatters and collapses. There is no way to reconstruct the jigsaw puzzle just created, because not only has the system changed, but so has the internal dynamics. Once broken, it's not fixable. If someone is foolish enough to destroy all the available drives to find out how they work, then it deserves to be lost to history. On the other hand, if the research is used to forward humanity's knowledge and exploration of the solar system and it breaks, then okay, replacements can be made. We do have high-tech scanning devices that can see inside your drive unit."
"A lot of information can be gotten that way," the man said, not backing down.
"Yes, sir. That's why I built in a cloak of deceit. There is no way of knowing the truth without seeing how it works. To see how it works requires disassembly. Disassembly means destruction of the device."
"I see. But you know how to open them, I take it?" His voice conveyed interest.
"Doubtful.
John pondered the question. It would be so tricky, it's simply not worth it. It's cheaper and easier to throw it away and build a new one from scratch. So if it breaks down somewhere without help nearby, there's always a spare ready to go. Trent Bishop was having a hard time punching holes in the guy's story. He was also having a hard time wrapping his head around what all had come to light in the past 2 weeks, but there it was. His only consolation was imagining what the two world-class cosmologists and the Nobel laureate physicist was going through 50 feet away in another room. "Then what are your plans for the drive?" he finally asked. John composed his thoughts. "I plan on setting up shop on Mars to complete the Step 3 drive, then test it to exhaustion. The power system for the test rig will be developed here on Earth by a company I've used in the past for the other drive units. Rachel's engineering group will finish designing the test rig and my team will build it." He stopped to rub his nose. "I call it a test rig because it's meant to do nothing more than test out the performance of the drive with minimal amounts of mass to move around. Rachel will then turn her attention to assembling a design team to build the actual vessel that the drive is meant for, with the intent being to begin the exploration of the Alpha Centauri system." John paused because he wanted to make sure that his words were reaching the man in front of him. Judging by the change in his face, he heard, but did not believe. John continued, "As long as the Step 3 drive unit functions up to spec and the necessary power requirements for the trip are addressed, a ship will voyage between our two systems within the next year and a half, give or take." The president had not taken a breath for quite a few seconds and his face had gone white. "You actually believe something like that is possible? You really think it's possible to travel to Alpha Centauri?" He blurted the words out, flabbergasted by the implications. "Yes," was the only thing he got back in return. "But how is that even possible? How long will it take to get there? It's 4 light years away, if I remember right." The president was looking pale at this point, appearing visibly shaken. It was time to slow things down just a bit. John pulled out his phone and motioned, as if questioning if it was okay to make a call, and the president nodded his consent. John looked up the name and hit call. As it was connecting, John asked if he could get a glass of water, and if the president wanted one too. He left the phone on the table and went to speaker. Seconds later, Rachel picked up. "Hiya," was the all too familiar greeting. "Rachel, I'm here with the president again, and I have a question for you." "Oh, let me get some more private. Hang on." The idea of having as much communication between the office of the president and her was going to be an important thing in the future. John was not sure how or why, but she needed to be the conduit, and John felt it important to start as soon as possible. Before sitting back down, he offered and refilled both glasses, setting the decanter down on the console table below a magnificent mirror she came back on. "Hello?" she began. "President Bishop here. Rachel, how are you?"
"I'm fine, sir. Thanks for asking."
"Here's your dad." "Rachel, how long will it take to get to Alpha Centauri?" The intermission lasted many seconds longer than it should, then. "Unless the president is hooking you up with some aliens from Area 51, a long time, seeing as how nothing is built." Both men looked at each other and smiled. "How about we try this again? In a year and a half, at Step 3, how long will it take? In fact, how about you make it a birthday present?"
"When's your birthday?" his daughter inquired.
John looked away from the phone and shook his head. "February 18th, he lied.
"Yeah, right. That's my birthday."
Then some muttering could be heard as she searched through her mind. October 9th, at which point she heard, "Yes, thank you." She dialed the date into the app she had written and said,
"At 10% thrust, 96 days, 4 hours, 27 minutes.
But remember, Dad, there will need to be many, many staging points to refuel. Burning that long means the length of time goes up by the number of stops needed.
The president's head shot up, not believing what he had just heard.
You can't be serious.
Rachel's jocular voice could be heard through the phone.
I bet you say that to all the girls, Mr. President. She giggled and went silent.
Rachel, if we work out the power needs, use a 20% thrust parameter.
20%? She cried. You won't have any fuel for the generator. What are you going to power it with, wind?
Just do it, please, her father pushed.
Okay, step 3, 20%.
Then a moment of silence.
74 days, 14 hours, 39 minutes.
Okay, thanks, sweetheart. That's all I had. Mr. President? The president shook his head, and the call ended with pleasantries.
74 days.
The word from the president's lips were soft. He was standing, gazing out the window, not sure how to take in the information that was being presented to him. The world was about to change in an unforeseeable way, and he was going to be sitting squarely in the middle of it.
If what this man was saying was true, how could such power be controlled? How does this guy think he can be trusted with it? He wondered.
In his mind, he replayed the video, first from the DoD spy satellite, then from the submarine recorded the previous evening. The satellite watched as the skiff descended through the atmosphere to gracefully land on the platform. The plasma exhaust was plainly visible now that they knew where to look. The platform then began its descent to the ocean surface, never touching, instead hovering 20 feet above the waves. It being a calm night, the thermal images were vivid. A dark supply boat vessel arrived, and people were offloaded with a crane using a personnel basket. Then the fuel hose from the floating tank was moved into position and mated to the platform. It took an hour for the refueling to be completed, after which a second group of people were craned over, along with 5 pallets of supplies. It was over in 2 hours. The platform took an additional 40 minutes to regain altitude where it currently resides even now.
What kind of tech is this? The platform did not cause any disturbance on the water surface like a helicopter would. Then there is a ship that's moving between Earth and the moon. Hydrogen plasma plume with perhaps gold mixed in with the spectral lines caused by the intense heat of the plasma. And if it is gold, who has money to throw gold out the back of an engine exhaust? And did it perhaps come from the moon? And what about the moon? There are people living and working there, and we are just now learning about it. What am I to make of that? He is planning on putting a base on Mars to construct a ship that will leave the solar system.
Reviewing all he had been told, Trent Bishop, the President of the United States, suddenly felt exceedingly small. The 8 people who had been monitoring the meeting from a video display knew that the President had been standing, staring out the window for several minutes, as Mr. West sat quietly. 4 of the people in attendance had been doing calculations and whispering amongst themselves. A soft whistle could be heard, and then more whispering, followed by explicative comments that brought on cussing and arguing.
Shh!
Could be heard from the other members in the group on a regular basis. None of them could believe what they had just heard. They all knew that the president was feeling the same turmoil as his inner demons wrestled with the facts in front of him. It was time for John to throw down the gauntlet. How would it be received? He nervously asked himself. Mr. President, I don't intend to give Earth any of my research ever. I have no intentions of sharing the information with anyone at any time, not in this system anyway. The president turned to face him again with a quizzical look on his face. I don't understand. Not in this system? What the hell does that mean? Mr. President, this tech is way too dangerous to be in just anyone's hands. I trust myself with it, because I have no desire to be some great conqueror.
but there are a lot of people out there who have that notion hardwired into their brain. Well, that's not fair. I don't know what led you to that conclusion, but I can assure you I am not one of them. I believe you. But in the wrong hands, it could be used to wreak havoc on a scale unimaginable. But I can trust you. Is that what you're telling me? You can trust me to leave the system with this research and make sure it's far enough away that when I do teach others how to build the drives, they won't have a clue where Earth is. If they turn around and destroy themselves, Earth won't suffer the consequences, but the planet can watch and learn how it's used or abused. So you're saying that we here on Earth lose out completely on the benefits of this device? No, sir. Only that no one in this system will know how the units function, and if there is ever a problem, the drives can be destroyed remotely before they can do any real damage. The tech will be lost, but the damage will be controlled. The president sat back in his seat and pondered the talk so far. This was not going anything like what he had imagined. John, what makes you think that someone in the near future won't design and build the very same thing as what you have now? They might, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. That's a pretty cocky attitude to have. What makes you so sure? Because I know how the kids are being taught, from a young age right up through the doctoral thesis. That makes no sense at all, John. You have to give me a little more than that to go on. Sure. If you had to describe the sun, how would you do it? It appeared to Trent Bishop that this guy wanted an answer from him. He gave it some thought and finally said, "It's a ball of hydrogen that is squeezed to create a nuclear reaction." Right. And if you had to describe the formation of the solar system, could you do that? Well, he thought for a second, the planets coalesce from a gas and dust cloud that over time form the planets and eventually orbits by gravity. Right. And if you had to describe gravity? Let's see. That's an Einstein thing. E equals mc squared. No, that's a conversion. Curved space-time, he finally said. Right. Gravity tells matter how to move, and matter tells space how to curve. Does that sound about right? Yes. That's why I'm confident that it will be a while before anyone builds another step drive, because everyone is taught the same thing. Are you saying it's wrong? I'm saying that certain academic roadblocks are going to lead people down the wrong path. Which means that's about all the hints you are going to share, the president stated. So, you are saying that we as a planet can still benefit from your invention? Ha, asked the president. Well, let me put it this way. I supply the bus, and I'm more than willing to take on riders. The riders must pay a fare. I make money. The riders get to the destinations and get picked up at some point. But the best buses are all mine. Nobody else gets to own one or build one or work on one unless they design and build one on their own. At which point, if they're looking for glory, they can patent it and win the Nobel Prize. But in the end, it wasn't me who gave out the information. They did it on their own. The president opened at this point. I was hoping our talk would center around you wanting us, the U.S. government, to assist you in your efforts to move into space, that we could work together to colonize and explore. What I think I'm hearing is you don't trust anyone but yourself, and if we pony up, we can come along for the ride. Yep, that sounds about right, John's reply floored everyone who was listening in. The only voice heard was the White House press secretary, who said, "What a dick!" The president, however, was starting to warm to the guy seated across from him and decided to take a different tack. "Okay, I'll bite. What is it you need from me?" John studied his face. There was a small amount of resentment, but there was also a significant level of interest and curiosity. Hopefully it would be enough. "What I really need from you, Mr. President, is a nuclear reactor.